Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I wanted to start out, well, taking a walk on the wild side, I guess. Maybe I'm entering into the lion's den, but if so, we'll just see what happens. I'm going to try to actually discuss a topic which has become, let's say, politicized, and I'm going to give you my opinion about the data and my opinion about the topic, and a few comments about what I observed when I was researching it. And why did I research the topic of ivermectin? Well, actually, because in the last 2 weeks, two of my patients have asked me about whether they could take ivermectin. One of these patients was a frail older woman who is very worried about getting COVID-19 and has multiple other health issues that make it problematic for her to take drugs. So any drugs, I always think twice when I have a frail elder confronting me. The other one was a much younger person, very good at reading papers, but not very good at critical thinking. Let me just launch off for a second into a digression about critical thinking. There's a lot to the concept of, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. In other words, I didn't learn my lesson and figure out how you fooled me and take steps not to be fooled in at least exactly that way again. And I don't believe that we do a good job educating people, and we haven't really been doing that for a while. I'm not quite sure where it happened, but the idea that understanding that all information is not equal and that you have to consider the source, as my mother would say. What does that mean? Well, consider the source means, does the person have some sort of interest in your believing them beyond just a conversational one? Do they stand to gain, perhaps financially or otherwise, if you believe them? Is what they say consistent? Can you cross-verify what they're saying from a source that isn't using them as a verification of what they're saying? I guess that's the best way to put it. Outside sources that aren't linked, very important, particularly now. Also, you know, what kind of vetting has something had? You know, back in the day of print media, things went through several editors. They went through a copy editor for grammar. They went through somebody for fact-checking. These people were paid by a large institution whose interest was not getting sued for libel or for false information and not having their credibility as an institution eroded by publishing too many stuff that was just wrong. There was a magazine when I was growing up called the National Enquirer, and the National Enquirer made its living as entertainment. No one actually believed what they read in the National Enquirer. It was probably complete fabrication. Some of it obvious, hilariously bad fabrication. And that's what made it entertaining. It's like, wow, that's a whopper. Tell me another tall tale, National Enquirer. But just because it was in print didn't mean it was credible. And we all knew that. It's funny how many people don't seem to know that now. So getting back to ivermectin, both of the patients in question gave me multiple websites to look at, and some of these websites actually said they have scientific evidence and referred to it, and one or two of them actually had a paper or two, and that there is scientific evidence statement, and then a little fig leaf to try to back it up is not what I expect to see and not what you should expect to see when someone makes a claim, particularly if it's a self-interested claim, as in, I am ready to let you join my my organization and pay me X dollars per month, and in return for which you will receive a fabulous product that I happen to have right here that I'm ready to sell you. And I have scientific evidence that this product works, and everyone who says it doesn't is lying because there's a vast conspiracy. Oh, let's start with the vast conspiracies. There was recently, I think a few days ago, somebody leaked something from a ultra-secret, you know, Trump, you know, inner circle meeting. And it wasn't a recording. I have no idea what it said. I just looked at it and swiped left, so to speak. But if arguably the most powerful person on the planet, the President of the United States, can't manage a decent conspiracy, how could you have a vast conspiracy across all doctors? I mean, you know, we often say, you know, getting doctors to agree is like herding cats. We're all very independent. We all have our own opinions, and we just love arguing about them. But we managed to reach a consensus based on our very high standards of evidence. And so I'm going to give you a digest based on that kind of standard, and you're going to find that I agree with the pro-ivermectin people on some of their points and not on others, and that I agree with the ivermectin isn't worthwhile people on some of their points and not on others, or at least in a milder way than it's stated on their websites. So I've reviewed a lot of web pages promoting it for COVID treatment and prevention. And while I was doing that, I found one website where they were selling it for fatty liver, and that set me off on a tangent. I'm like, ivermectin and fatty liver? You know, so go off to Open Evidence, off to a couple of Google Scholar, and nope, no data, no papers, nothing. So they just kind of threw that out there, I guess, to say that this really is a wonder drug. So when you read, when you look at these web pages that are promoting ivermectin for COVID treatment, the prevention piece, by the way, kind of came along for the ride later. But initially, I'm sure you remember 2020. I know I do. And the hospitals were flooded. Everyone was freaking out, and we were madly looking for something that we could do for these people who were doing their best to die in our emergency rooms. And a lot of people started working the problem, if you will. And along about 2021, this is the most cited paper I could find. It was a Bulgarian trial, about 300 people, and it purported to show that people who took ivermectin were exposed to a family member who was sick, so presumably were doing caretaking, although it's very hard to find the methods section for that paper. All I could find were abstracts. But assuming that they had a bunch of people who were caring for their loved ones, and some of them took ivermectin and some of them didn't, and 77% of the people caring for their loved ones who took ivermectin didn't get COVID, and presumably more of the ones who were caring for theirs did. Again, the data's a little sketchy, but let's give it that was what it showed. Let's give it statistical significance, just for the sake of argument. That's one study. And we don't believe anything unless it replicates. Also, 300's a, you know, fairly small number. 3,000 would be better. So big studies, like 3,000, would be expected to show even small benefit. It would, the larger the number of people, the more easy it is to achieve statistical significance. And so that's important to know, because if you ever come across a study where there's 30,000 subjects and they say it reduces X disease by 5%, you have to ask yourself, do I care? It might be statistically significant, but it also might be actually clinically meaningless. And so that's the critical thinking that we're stuck with having to do with these issues. But big studies, which would be expected to show even small beneficial effects of ivermectin, didn't really back it up as effective. And we'll get into a little bit more detail about a couple of those big studies in a few moments. So what's the problem with ivermectin? Okay, first of all, let's talk about safety, because I think that's the thing that most medical doctors are worried about, is that it's given once every couple of weeks clinically in the world, 12 milligrams or 400 micrograms per kilogram. And that's the dose that's given for the parasites. And it works. And if you're in an area where you're constantly getting reinfected with parasites because of they're everywhere and you don't have good quality water, you're going to need it, and people do just fine with it. So that's kind of the threshold that I walked into this problem with. And actually, it is pretty safe. It can build up if you give it every day. The safety study from 2002 that established it as a good agent tested it by giving people that dose, 400 micrograms per kilogram, which works out to about 12 milligrams for the average adult. They gave it every 3 days. They gave it at days 1, 4, and 7. That's it. And they looked and saw it didn't bioaccumulate. They didn't go much further than that, but that was enough, because you were only planning to give it as an, you know, like a bug bomb for your parasites. You weren't planning to take it for months to keep you from getting a disease, and no one even had that in their mind. Now, ivermectin is really good at killing insects and parasites, and it doesn't kill mammals, which would include us, because we have a blood-brain barrier and efflux. And the way it kills insects is by destroying their nervous systems. And it doesn't destroy ours, because we have this special structure that keeps what's in our bloodstream from getting into our brain, nice, thick, no man's land that the substance has to cross, called the blood-brain barrier. And furthermore, we have a second line of defense against ivermectin in our brain, which is something in our lining of our blood vessels called an efflux machine that pushes the ivermectin out of the wall of the blood vessel. So it would have to get through the wall of the blood vessel to get into the no man's land, to get into the brain, and it gets pushed back and back into the bloodstream and is washed away at the next heartbeat. And that efflux mechanism is very effective in most of us. There are occasionally people who have mutations. And oddly enough, little fun fact here, border collies, especially the purebred border collies, tend to not have good efflux, and ivermectin is known to be very toxic to border collies, and it basically causes the same thing it causes in humans when they get in trouble, that causes encephalitis. What's that? Well, encephalitis used to be called brain fever. It was the thing that you get when you have malaria or a high fever, where you have hallucinations and seizures and shakes and your cognition is shot, and it's you're delirious, right? That's encephalopathy, and it's very, very scary to see. And that's in short-term overdose. We see that in humans. It's usually in people who've made a math error, maybe, in figuring out how much they should be taking, or they've gone and not been able to get a doctor who would prescribe it, a problem that no longer exists, for good or for ill. Now, you don't have to go to your vet barn. You can actually get it online from websites that will happily sell it to you and write you the prescription, I might add, which is like extraordinarily unethical. Anyway, brain fever, encephalopathy, that's short-term overdose. Those are obvious. Now, they've studied it now. We've had enough human examples of people who've been taking 12 milligrams a day for months in order to not get COVID, which is absolutely not established, by the way. And even if it were true, it would be a small benefit. It wouldn't be like a real slam dunk because we haven't been able to see it in those big studies. So not a big benefit, just like that clinical, not clinically important thing I was talking about earlier. But long term, you know, you start to get liver damage and kidney damage and big, big issue, birth defects. So all those fertile women out there who are taking ivermectin so they don't get a problem with COVID might actually be setting themselves up for something worse. And there's drug interactions. This I totally did not know, and I've never seen it on any of the medical sites that I've looked at where they're making an argument against using it, which was interesting. So all of the Biaxin, azithromycin, erythromycin, all the macrolide antibiotics actually will mess up that efflux and cause the stuff to be able to get into your brain, as will verapamil, which is one of the most commonly used drugs for hypertension and atrial fib, the proton pump inhibitors, which are available over the counter, and certain beta blockers. So those interfere with your ability to keep it out of your brain. And they say take it on an empty stomach. That's actually to decrease the absorption. If you take your ivermectin with a high-fat meal, you increase the absorption by 2.5-fold. That's 250%. So even that 12-milligram dose is effectively a 28-milligram dose, something like that. It really is a big deal. So let's go to that comment I made about you won't have to worry about going to the veterinarian stores anymore. A lot of our data on that encephalopathy comes from people who bought the stuff that you're supposed to spread on your horses and or give to your cows. And the veterinary stuff is much more concentrated. It's like 1.86%. And so that's a lot of milligrams per dose. And people were giving themselves 400, you know, 600 accumulated milligrams over a couple of days, and they were getting encephalopathic. Most of the bad side effects occur with people who were, you know, it's the equivalent of the aquarium cleaner because you can't get hydroxychloroquine any other way. The websites really appalled me. It's the same thing that happened with GLP-1, where they would, where you could go online, and I'm not going to name names, but there are a number of websites where you essentially pay them a fee and you have a 10-minute visit on or a 5-minute visit with a doctor. They say, you know, how tall are you? What do you weigh? Okay, you're officially obese. And where would you like this sent? And write the prescription. And I'm sure that they ask about, did anybody in your family ever have an endocrine tumor? And if you don't say yes, then they probably give it to you. And of course, you pay a fee. You pay a fee for being a member and having that doctor visit, and then you get to buy your GLP-1, and it gets mailed to you. And this is, in the United States, apparently legal. Well, the same thing can happen with ivermectin. I found, without looking very hard at all, two sites that will sell you 12 milligrams a day, and it works out to about $3 a capsule. So I don't know what the membership is or the doctor fee is, but, you know, if you think it through, that's $100 a month for something that may or may not do anything for you. And it almost seems like people are much smarter if they were going to buy a car or an appliance. You know, they would look more carefully at products, and it's almost as if they're tithing. I don't understand the fear. I guess if you're afraid of vaccination, then you're afraid of COVID, this seems like a good way to buy yourself free of the fear, but I'm afraid it's not actually shifting your risk. It's just letting you buy some peace of mind. but you're not really getting anything for it. So I kind of came to the conclusion after all that reading and all those websites that, with all due respect, no, I don't think the data is strong enough for you to do this. I respect your right to go spend money on what I see as an illusory benefit. And that's basically it. That's the diatribe, such as it is, on ivermectin. So I have a little interesting tidbit for you. And this is a formula that you can use to calculate your risk. A friend of mine just had a stroke. And one of the things that we know about stroke recovery is if you have high inflammation, that you can have a worse time with your stroke recovery. More of your brain will be damaged. We have fairly sophisticated tests, high-sensitivity reactive protein, ESRs, but most people don't have one of those. But what almost everyone has is a complete blood count in sometime in the last year, a CBC. It turns out that there are two formulas that are very useful. One of them is called a systemic inflammatory index, and it tells you whether you have inflammation that is running away in your blood. So we would say inflammation outpacing the regulatory function. We see that post-stroke outcomes are worse in these situations, and we see that if you have cancer and this number is going up, it indicates either increasing tumor burden, or you'll also see it bump when the cancer metastasizes, all from a CBC. So let me give you this formula, because it's a good early warning system, and most doctors don't know about it and aren't using it. I queried the residents at the family medicine residency recently, and like two of them had heard of it. It wasn't being used on the wards. So I hope that my little lecture then will change that. But here it is for you. If you look at your blood count, you're going to see neutrophils and lymphocytes, and you're going to see platelets. So the formula is neutrophils times platelets divided by lymphocytes. Simple mathematical formula. If the number is between 200 and 500, you're good. That's excellent. If the number is above 900, that's a very bad sign and warrants further investigation, depending upon your circumstances. But that's an indication that your inflammation is outrunning the system, and something that should be holding it back isn't. There has to be a reason. The other one is the CIRI, another formula, also very simple. It stands for chronic tissue-related inflammation. So one of them is sort of acute runaway. The other one is low-grade simmer. So that one is the neutrophils times another cell type, the monocytes, divided by the lymphocytes. And this is tissue damage. It could be, you could also see it in very, very early viral infection when in a virus you've never seen before. So that would be early acute innate immunity. And the reason is the early acute innate immunity, the natural killer cells, and the other parts of that part of the immune system, the one that isn't previously exposure mediated, is basically cells walking around with flamethrowers killing other cells. So there's a lot of tissue damage involved. The other time you're going to see that is in low-grade chronic inflammation. Low-grade inflammation, not rising, just kind of smoldering away. Chronic infection anywhere, in the prostate, in the sinuses, in the gut, and also bad amounts of arterial plaque. So the CIRI correlates quite well with cardiovascular mortality and the risk of stroke. If it's chronically elevated monocytes, which is what gives you this high number, chronically elevated monocytes means the bone marrow is sending the monocytes into tissues to turn into M1 or pro-inflammatory macrophages, the cleanup guys. the kill and clean up amoebas that go around and gobble everything up like little Pac-Men, but they cause tissue damage in the process.
If the Siri value is less than 500, that's good, and you don't have any excess inflammation. If it's greater than 1500, then you should investigate with further testing. In the literature, you will see those values reported as 0.5 and 1.5, but that's because the complete blood count units they used in some of the articles are different by a factor of 1,000. The values of 500 and 1500 work using your Quest Lab CBC test results.
It's really a very, very useful test. Let's talk about one more thing that came out of this same lecture at the Institute for Functional Medicine annual conference, and that is when you use these numbers and they're elevated, take a look at the cholesterol. And if the person is in the high-risk group for by cholesterol for coronary artery disease, start giving them fish oil. If you're in a high-risk quartile for cholesterol for coronary artery disease, for every gram per day of EPA and DHA, which are two subunits in omega-3 fatty acids, you get a 9% risk reduction. 9%. That is about as good as our drugs. So it's a matter of how much can I take, right? And the answer is you stop at bruising and cut back to a lower dose. You don't want to have bruising because that is too much thinning and you've reached the point of diminishing or, you know, reverse returns. I love this quote. We don't need randomized clinical trials to tell us we need a parachute if we're jumping out of a plane. So that is another highlight. And one last highlight from the annual international conference of the Institute for Functional Medicine, which I attended last month, there's a natural inflammation which occurs in the body after we eat. And if we draw blood right after we eat, we'll find a lot of fat in the blood, even if it's been a low-fat meal. It has to do with a lot of factors. And the most important thing that I can tell you is that if you walk for 15 minutes within 30 minutes of eating your meal, especially your big meal of the day, so that within 30 minutes you get up and you take a 15-minute walk, and it doesn't have to be a run. You just have to get up and walk around. You will reduce almost to zero the postprandial inflammation that would ordinarily occur. So some cool news you can use and some calculations to make up for putting up with me through my diatribe and wander on the ivermectin. Now, this was a letter from one of my patients who, of course, will remain nameless. And an endocrinologist told me that vitamin D can leach calcium from the bones. Is this true? And can you give me a fact check? And so that seems paradoxical. We all think of vitamin D as improving absorption of a calcium from the gut and helping the bones. But under specific conditions, it turns out it can promote reabsorption. And you have to look at the clinical contents. Really, the role of vitamin D is to maintain circulating calcium levels. And bone serves as a reservoir of calcium, a reserve tank, if you will. And a study done called the Calgary Vitamin D Study, which was a 3-year randomized clinical trial of 373 healthy adults, did show that if you took high-dose vitamin D, that's 10,000 units a day, there was increased bone reabsorption. They saw an increased C-telopeptide, which is a marker that we don't want to see increase because it indicates the bone is being broken down, and also a decrease in the parathyroid hormones secretion. In other words, since those are the ones that take calcium levels up,
when the calcium levels are already high, you're not going to be putting that one out, just the balancing mechanism in our innate physiological structure. What's going on there? Well, it turns out that if you have too much 125 vitamin D, that is the problem. Too much 125 vitamin D will get you into serious trouble. And it stimulates the birth of new cells to break down bone. And this is sort of a side effect that is unexpected because you don't usually see elevated high levels of 125 vitamin D, except in very high inflammation situations. And there again, it's sort of an unwanted side effect. But it's also the reason why in chronic infection, we tend to see over time bone loss, even if the infection isn't in the bone. So if you really are toxic with your vitamin D, and that's levels of over 150 nanograms, I start to get worried above 90. And that's, so you'd have to be taking a lot of it and essentially overdosing on it. But as long as people keep their their vitamin D levels in the range of 5,000 or less, and sometimes you can have vitamin D actually increase bone reabsorption. I think vegans who have low stomach acid are going to have a hard time getting enough calcium from their vegetables. That's just part of how we get calcium out of vegetables, is we have to apply acid to the cell wall of the vegetables. And if that's a problem for you and you're taking high-ish doses of vitamin D, you could also get into trouble. So, you know, the answer is yes, but it's not very common, and I'm not particularly worried about it in most people. So last week we talked a little bit about questions that younger people had, and I had this one question that we didn't have a chance to get to. This was some stuff that Mira brought to the show when she made her monthly appearance. How are histamines shaped in women? Are they correlated with our hormones and minerals? Thank you for asking the question. It gets me a chance to talk a little bit about something that we mainly think in terms of sneezing and wheezing. But histamine's actually a pretty important neurotransmitter in the brain, and it's an inflammatory mediator in the immune system, not just for allergies, but obviously we think about allergies. It promotes acid secretion in the stomach. We were just talking about that in the context of calcium. It promotes GI motility, and it actually heightens visceral sensory sensation. So if you have high levels of histamine, you're going to feel kind of queasy and a little distended and maybe a tad sore. And if you aren't able to process histamine that's coming in food or being converted from food, because bacteria in your gut are converting histidine, which is an amino acid, into histamine. They're so close. It's an easy one-step conversion. And when that happens, and by the way, those bacteria can actually do this outside of your body. It occasionally happens that people will eat fish and that's been sitting and get a massive histamine reaction, almost like an anaphylactic shock reaction, and it's just because they have just consumed so much histamine from the breakdown of the fish protein that they've flooded their body's ability to handle it. But basically, histamine is very important in gut function, and you may have heard of a drug called Tagamet or a drug called Zantac, and these are given as stomach acid relievers, and they are actually histamine blockers. So they block something called the type 2 histamine receptor. And in your nose, you've got the type 1 receptor. So we have histamine 2 blockers and histamine 1 blockers. And as I said, the gut flora also make histamine. So in the brain, as a neurotransmitter, it causes you to be alert and wakeful. It's very important in stimulating waking and your circadian rhythms. It's also important in pain perception. It's released under, there is an increased release under stress and under anxiety. And actually, the disease narcolepsy, one of the features of that, where people just sort of fall asleep while standing up or driving just for no accountable reason, one of the things that's missing in their brain is actually they aren't producing adequate amounts of histamine. They are effectively correlated to our hormones, not necessarily to our minerals, to answer that question. Let's see. Another question about women. How important are B vitamins for women in their mid-20s? Again, it all depends on diet. If you are not eating a lot of leafy green vegetables and other greens, you may not be getting enough B vitamins. And so it's probably good to take some extra calcium, maybe take some orange juice with that calcium tablet or a little apple cider vinegar, and a B100 if your diet is, if you're a vegetarian or if your diet is pretty much exclusively ramen with the occasional fast food hamburger, you're definitely want to beef that up a little bit, and not with beef. For women in their mid-20s who might get pregnant, being on prenatal vitamins is actually a pretty good idea as well. So, next question. When you inhale, your stomach and belly should protrude, but the way most of us take deep breaths, our chest protrudes forward instead of our stomach. And my friend has heard it's bad for your cervix if you're a woman. Well, as far as breathing with your chest instead of your stomach being bad for your cervix, I have never heard that, and I don't think it's true. But if you want to learn how to breathe properly, go watch a baby breathe. Babies have two modalities, right? Sleep and cry. And if the baby is in cry mode, you'll see them using their chest accessory muscles. You'll see their shoulders going up as they breathe in. And that's to get a big, extra deep breath so that they can make a big, extra loud noise. And if you see that in a baby who is not crying, you need to be worried that that baby has pneumonia, because the use of accessory muscles, the tightening of the neck with the inhalation in an infant or a young child, is a very bad sign. Getting back to adults, as you breathe in, your belly button should lift or move forward. If you're standing up, it'll be moving out. Your chest wall really shouldn't be moving except at the very end of the inspiration. So if you're lifting it on the first part of your breath, you're using those chest wall accessory muscles. And so it is true, when you inhale, your stomach and belly should protrude. And when we are asleep, that is how we breathe. When we are awake, it's common that people will with their breath, and it's caused by a fight or flight mechanism. It not only is caused by elevated epinephrine, it'll actually raise your epinephrine or your adrenaline if you breathe that way. So I highly recommend learning to belly breathe. And if you're feeling even the slightest bit anxious, put your attention on your navel. You know that old joke about contemplating your navel? Well, I think it's actually a good idea. All right, we've got this one. How can you stop compulsively scratching your own body? Well, there's a whole actual ICD-10 code for people who compulsively scratch. And it's in there in the same category with people who compulsively chew their nails and people who compulsively pull out their hair. And these are all neurohabits, and I'm sorry, these are all habits, but they can become kind of hardwired and compulsive in your brain. And when that happens in the skin, the scratching, of course, causes some damage, and it causes very characteristic-looking little scabby lesions and bumps. And at that point, we call it neurodermatitis. And one of the ways that you diagnose
and differentiate neurodermatitis from a viral rash or from scabies or anything else is that the neurodermatitis is going to be spared on the places that the person can't reach. Now, if I have a viral infection that gives me a rash, or I have a food allergy that gives me a rash, or I have guttate psoriasis that gives me a rash, I'm going to have it on my back between my shoulder blades. But the lower that spot just between the shoulder blades and down a little bit that nobody can reach without a stick, if that's the only place that isn't scratched, you're looking at the itch that the scratch that itches. Essentially, people have damaged the skin and now they are generating their own injury and their own chemicals that are creating itch. The best way to break this, of course, clip the nails, use lubricants to make it hard to scratch hard on the nails, cover the areas that are scabbed and give them a chance to heal. And, you know, this is where I dig out the prescription pad and give out some Prozac, because Prozac, of all of these antidepressants, has an interesting property at having a secondary indication for neurodermatitis. So just a little tip, maybe something that you would find useful. We've got time for maybe, let's have a couple of quickie, interesting little stories. I had this from last week that we didn't get to, and that is scientists have built a microscopic repair crew that may one day patch up severed spinal cords. Researchers in Zurich combined immature human nerve cells with magnetic nanoparticles to create what they called NPC bots, each one 6 micrometers across. That's smaller than a red blood cell, a tenth the width of a strand of human hair. By using magnets, the bots can be nudged to mature into nerve tissue by tiny pulses from the same particles. So basically, you pull them over into position with the magnet, and then you give them a pulsatile magnetic impulse. They tested this first in zebrafish, which are small, and then they tried them on mice with severed spinal cords. 500,000 bots were injected in a gel into the injury site of each mouse and then given 30-minute bursts of magnetic stimulation daily for 2 weeks. And by day 34, the treated mice had regained movements and electrical signals were traveling between the brain and the muscle. It'll be a long time before we can figure out how to do this in humans. This is purely experimental. But the idea of using magnetism to allow us to position things or to cause them to accumulate in otherwise inaccessible areas, I think, has real potential in medicine. Genetic factors appear to play a role in the development of chronic fatigue syndrome. This condition, myalgic encephalomyelitis, is actually fairly widespread and poorly understood. A new study analyzing the DNA of over 15,000 people with the condition has identified 8 areas where their genetic code differs significantly from that of people without it. 2 of the areas, or genetic signals, relate to the body's immune response to infection. An aha moment for researchers, as many sufferers say their symptoms began after an infection. Long COVID, or at least one variety of the several varieties of long COVID, parenthetically, is a form of myalgic encephalomyelitis. Other areas that were genetically altered are linked with the nervous system and chronic pain. These signals align with how people with ME/CFS describe their illness, said study leader Chris Ponting of the University of Edinburgh. It's a forgotten and forsaken disease that should have had a genetic study like this 15 years ago. The results could pave the way for the development of diagnostic tests or screening, as well as potential avenues for treatment. In the United States, an estimated 3 million people, and about half of the people with long COVID, as I mentioned earlier, also meet the criteria for this disorder. What's going on? The immune system's gotten switched on, and it can't switch itself off. a basic function of the immune system is to rev up and fight and then know when to hit the brakes. And when you can't hit the brakes, you're on a runaway train. And that is a good description of ME, CFS. And it uses so much of your energy just to rev that engine over and over again against a an enemy that is long gone. And we have to be able to figure out a way to reset the system. And that maybe some of this research will eventually bring us to the point of being able to do. I have another email. This one is about prostate cancer. Or actually, prostate biopsy, I should say. Because there have been changes in the way we test for the prostate now. So when a person has an elevated PSA, the next step is to do an MRI of the prostate and see if we see any area of increased metabolic activity. And if we do see that, then we go for a targeted biopsy. And the biopsies of the prostate used to be done through the rectum, so that you would be poking through the rectal skin and getting in. But of course, you can't really sterilize the rectal area completely. The new approach is called the transperineal biopsy. And so rather than going through the rectum, you're going through the skin between the scrotum and the anus. And this transperineal approach significantly lowers infection risk and eliminates the need for antibiotics each time. And it's local anesthesia. It's the rectal approach is faster and less painful. So all that's plus for the rectal approach. There's about a 1.5% risk of post-biopsy infections in the transrectal, and in the transperineal, the infection rate is zero to near zero. And again, no antibiotics are needed, so you don't run the risk of antibiotic. It does require more local or general anesthesia, and it can cause bruising in that area. It's more time-consuming. They have the same cancer detection rates when combined with MRI targeting. So there's no consensus, I think, as I think we'll see the world moving to the transperineal approach due to its successful safety profile, its superior safety profile. And now we're getting MRIs just about everywhere. So it'll probably be a slow transition over the next couple of years. I expect to see that shift entirely. And let's do one more, just a quick one. We were talking about histamine earlier. So I bet this connection never occurred to you. Plants take their cues to flower and release pollen from two things, temperature and light. And it turns out the artificial glare that bathes urban areas at night appears to scramble the internal clocks. Analyzing pollen counts and satellite data across the northeastern U.S. for 11 years, researchers at Vanderbilt found that the more light pollution a place endured, the higher its pollen levels and the longer its allergy season. In some areas, extra urban lighting caused allergy seasons to extend by as much as 2 weeks. Seasonal allergies, of course, have a major downside. They cost billions of dollars in healthcare costs and make life miserable for those who are sensitive. Whether this particular bit of research is anything more than another example of how our decisions that we make and how we live interacts with the environment in unexpected ways, I don't think that it's anything more than a curiosity. But as curiosities go, it's a pretty interesting one. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.